philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن هذه القلوب تمل كما تمل الأبدان فابتغوا لها طرائف الحكمة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "The hearts become tired as the bodies become tired. You should therefore search for beautiful sayings for them to enjoy by way of refreshment."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, in this truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali, talks about the heart. Now, when he talks about the heart, he tells us the different aspects of this heart. Now, we're not necessarily talking about specifically this physical material heart, which is in our rib cage and in our chest. Now, there is a possibility that this is what is being spoken about, but in reality, what is being spoken about is this heart and this emotional center, this center of where the love of Allah presides in one's heart. Now, one of the things that we tend to do as human beings is to have hope in other people. So, for example, sometimes among the busyness of our daily lives, we believe that, you know, such and such manager has the solutions to our problem, or a certain teacher or a certain expert in a medical field, or a certain professor or a certain guide or a certain individual has the solutions to our problems. Now, interestingly, when we feel that an individual, a human being, has the answers to our problems and the solutions to our problems, well, we begin to set our hopes upon that certain individual. Well, before I say what I was going to say, first and foremost, we must set our hopes upon the mighty, the exalted Allah. All of our hopes and all of the solutions to our problems are with the Almighty Allah. That needs to be something that we establish in our heart and in our soul. And of course, other individuals who might have the solutions to our problems are, for example, the Holy Prophet, the divinely appointed Imams from the household of the Holy Prophet, and, you know, it comes down to the religious scholars, the honorable and righteous religious scholars, and of course our parents, and so forth. But our hope should always and ultimately be upon Allah. Here Imam Ali alayhi salam says something really interesting. He says, whoever sets their hope on others, the latter's awe and glory will be in your heart. And so, of course, as we have said in other programs as well, and as the spiritual masters of the acquirement of the love of Allah teach us, the heart should be the place where only the awe and glory of Allah should be. And therefore, our ultimate hope and our ultimate gaze, metaphorically speaking, should be upon Allah, for we only want Allah's awe and glory in our heart. And as Imam Ali says, if we set our hopes upon people or certain individuals, then it is that person's awe and glory which will be established in our heart. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah, to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen, I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away, and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Prophet saying, Ya Ali, now the Quran says, Ma atakum ar-rasulu fakhudhu. Whatever the Prophet did, you and I must do. When the Prophet says, Ya Ali, then I will also say, Ya Ali. In addition to this, some people may ask the question, fine, the Prophet of Islam mentioned Ya Ali, but did he specifically say, well, you and I must mention it? Of course he did. You'll find the famous narration in which we find it in several books by our brothers Ahl Sunnah, such as what? Such as Kanz al-Ummal by Al-Muttaqil Hindi in volume 11, such as the book by Allama Jalaluddin al-Suyuti, Al-Jami' al-Saghir, such as the book by Ibn Asakir, Tariq Dimashq, non-Shia books. They come forward and say that Rasulullah said, ذِكْرُ عَلِيٍّ عِبَادَةً The mentioning of Ali is worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. People ask the question, when the Prophet says, ذِكْرُ عَلِيٍّ عِبَادَةً the mentioning of Ali is what is worship. What does this mean? Does this mean, God forbid, it is the worship of the commander of the faithful? Of course not, because Amir al-Mu'mineen is a servant of God. In fact, the Prophet of Islam is described in the Holy Quran as what? As Abdullah. When the Quran comes forward and says, Subhanalladhi asra bi'abdihi laylan min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa alladhi barakna hawla. That's why, of course, this station of servitude was one that was what? Expressed by the holy Ahlul Bayt. But what does it mean when the Prophet of Islam says, Dhikru Aliyin Ibadah, the mentioning of Ali is worship? What does this mean? It means that Ali ibn Abi Talib is the champion of Tawheed. It refers to the idea that through Ali ibn Abi Talib, we can get proximity to Allah. We can understand what Tawheed in reality is. We can appreciate the worship of the Almighty subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why you ask me? I tell you, Amir al-Mu'mineen was born in the house of God. He was martyred in the house of God. And in between, his life was dedicated to Tawheed. We believe when you and I state, Ya Ali, it is what? One of its applications is what? Is tawassul. We are seeking nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami, dini wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the non-believers related rules or jurisprudential status according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, of course, we're going to take a listen to a short biography. Let's stay with us.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. So,
back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Well, Sheikh Javid, let's talk about the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about the non-believers or kafir. Sheikh Javid, let me start off this episode, Sheikh Javid, with this question. If a deceased body, a dead body, in fact, is found in a Muslim country, all right, or a non-Muslim country, how are we supposed to deal with it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It depends on the predominant population. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
If a dead body is found in a Muslim country, and even if there are no signs suggesting that that dead body belongs to that of a Muslim man or that of a Muslim woman, that dead body is treated as Muslim, because the dead body is found in a Muslim territory, in a Muslim country. And a Muslim country is, of course, supposed to be predominantly Muslim populated country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we are supposed to do and how we are supposed to behave with to treat that dead body. Now, when it comes to a dead body found in a predominantly non-Muslim populated country, like, for example, in let's say in America or in Brazil or in UK, in the UK, for example, if a dead body is found in a jungle,
mm-hmm.
and there is no sign, no nothing to indicate that that dead body is the dead body of a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
then that dead body is treated as that of a non-Muslim individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, when that body is treated as such, it will not be permissible to pray on that dead body,
mm-hmm.
and it will not be permissible to bury that dead body in a Muslim cemetery.
It will not be permissible to bury
that in a Muslim cemetery.
But is it obligatory to bury it at all?
It will be, of course, because as a Muslim, you can bury it anywhere outside, okay?
In the jungle,
dead body,
probably.
The dead body cannot be left, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Left in the jungle,
yes.
For the for carnivorous animals,
mm-hmm.
animals to eat.
Pray
it.
On it, yeah.
Okay, so it can be buried, but there's no ritual prayer, funeral prayer, and no other
rituals, formal offer.
Yeah.
All right.
No formalities are there for such a dead body.
I see. That's because, in fact, the whole area is supposed to be non-Muslim populated.
Yeah, that's the main condition.
Uh-huh.
You know? And if also I said that if there are no signs suggesting or indicating that that body belongs to a Muslim individual,
but
then
in the Muslim areas?
Of course, in the Muslim area.
You have to consider that Muslim,
yeah,
right?
You have to consider because of the the majority population.
Yes.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a very short break and we'll be back and continue our program of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker here, kindly talking about, in fact, some of the fatwas about the non-believers and non-Muslims. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to ask you a question which may or may not be very related to Sharia. But I'm kind of confident that Islam has a kind of idea about it, at least. Well, how is it possible to reconcile the impurity that you've been talking about and ascribed it, in fact, to the non-believers, right, or the kafir, with human dignity. How would you reconcile the two? I mean, impurity and human dignity. On the one hand, we say that a man is a dignified creature because he's or she's created by God. And on the other, Islam considers a kafir to be impure. How would you balance that?
You're right. Well, a man or human being is created superior to other animals.
Mm-hmm.
And every other creature is supposed to be at man's service. Now, of course, that's largely because of the fact that man is gifted with the faculty of intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what gives him somehow excellence or superiority over other creatures. That's the intrinsic dignity that man has. And, of course, the essential or intrinsic dignity is something that God has bestowed upon man. But as far as the acquisitive dignity is concerned, or the acquired dignity is concerned, of course, we do believe that man can acquire as much, excellence, virtue, and noble traits as he can. There is no limit. There is no hindrance to his efforts to accomplish more and more attribute noble virtues. And of course, when it comes to human dignity, of course, because we are running out of time, I have to be very quick.
Mm-hmm.
I should say that, okay, man's dead body has to be respected, even if that dead body belongs to a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Islam gives importance to respecting each other. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says, "An-nas sinfan, imma akhun laka fi din aw nadhirun laka fil khalq." There are two groups of people, okay. Either they are your brothers in faith, or they are your brothers in religion.
Mm-hmm.
They are in either case, whether they are so they are human beings,
mm-hmm.
and they are not out of these two categories. So if they are human beings, you should respect them. So if a Muslim or a non-Muslim, so the dead body is there, you are not going to disrespect the non-Muslim, kick it, okay, or burn it, or do anything that you would like. It's not permissible to burn the body of a criminal, a non-Muslim, and disrespect it. Okay, you have to respect that dead body. Okay, you are not supposed to pray on that dead body, but you should respect it. You should treat it with respect and dignity, because God has given dignity to that. And essential dignity is there. As long as us, as a being, as a creature, is called human being, that creature is dignified. Okay. As far as the acquisitive dignity is concerned, of course, this is not very much, as you rightly mentioned, very much related to Islamic laws.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the more pious we are, the more pious we are, the closer we are. Inna akramakum inda Allahi atqakum. Okay, that's the Quran. That's what the Quran says. Okay, the best of you to Allah is the most pious of you, the most God conscious of you to Allah. So there is no limit, there is no impediment, and there is no restriction when it comes to acquiring virtue, acquiring piety, acquiring noble traits and noble qualities. And the more you get these noble qualities, the closer you are to Allah, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can get as close to Allah as an angel, because the Quran says, "Fi maq'adi sidqin inda malikin muqtadir," you can be as close to God as the angels are. So there's no limitation. And the more, of course, you get closer to Allah, the more respected, the more noble you are, because if you are close to Allah, then you are obviously more dignified.
Mm-hmm.
This has something to do with the acquisitive, or the acquired dignity, which depends on how much efforts you take and how much struggle you make. You know, that is it. So we have two categories of two types of dignity. One is acquisitive, and the other is innate or intrinsic. And that's because of this. It is because of this dignity that we are supposed to respect human bodies. We should treat them with respect and dignity, and we should not disrespect them, no matter whether the dead body belongs to a Muslim or a non-Muslim.
I appreciate it, Sheikh. Thank you very much for you, actually, and for your listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some like when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying, that, you know, it's clearly stated, just as it's very interesting for me, because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of, and if we look at historically, and you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming and becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone. Between Germany and Russia, where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia. Anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening in the end of the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there is serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a ministry of industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight, a lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the U.S. as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profits. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, of course, in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and in trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Ghazayev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming an inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it.
To be brief, according to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well. The British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America. This is because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. Still, American dollar dominates in all transactions which you mentioned in the currency reserves. But it is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor. And by the Europeans, yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia, mm-hmm. and it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system against Russia, and they did not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well, America, and for India, I am sure, American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy, in the chemical sector, in water, in coal, in a lot of commodities, we can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange, mm-hmm. which will generate its own prices. Prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities, And that, so yes. is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That yes. This would
the
then
idea,
be...
Go
ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used for the border transactions. This currency should be constructed on the basis of the basket of the national currencies mm-hmm. of those countries which are involved in this process, like a special development, special deposit rights of the IMF.
Yes.
But on the basis of the another principles, more fair and more clear. And another part of this currency should be the basket of commodities. If you combine together the basket of national currencies and basket of commodities and create the synthetic currency based on this about 30 subjects in the basket, we can go create a very a strong currency which will be very stable in spite of all the international conjuncture.
So excuse me, doctor, so let me understand you correctly. So this currency is not a currency that we in different countries would be having in our wallets, in our bank accounts. We would still be using our national accounts. This would be a purely international currency used for the transaction between countries for the sale of the commodities that exist, that it would be backed by the power of the national currencies and by the commodities that are so abundant in Asia. Which is interesting because you talked about fiat money. It's actually very, very new that we have fiat money. For throughout human history, we actually had commodity-backed money. We had money that there was something that people could back it with. So this is going back to that, in a certain way, going back to that.
Yes, but you are quite right. In international transactions, if you are speaking about the national economies, each country has its own national currency.
Very good.
Fiat currency, which can be used for monetary support of the investment activity. But the currency which I'm talking about is the currency for international transactions. Of course, we need some kind of organization like that. For instance, in BRICS, we have the basket of the reserve currencies of BRICS. We can involve BRICS countries as well, not only Asian countries, but let's take also Brazil and South Africa, use the BRICS organization. So the idea is to get rid from any kind of private monopoly on the world money. The new world money should be created on the basis of international treaty. This is the first foundation of the new economic world economic structure. The second foundation is the information technologies. As you know, the American Agency of National Security is the cyber terrorist number one in the world. Mm-hmm. Almost about half of cyber attacks are coming from the United States, from the one place, Agency of National Security. The United States is the only country which don't want to sign the International Treaty for Cybersecurity. So our peace coalition should also has another, not only monetary treaty, but also treaty on information technologies, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism. And those countries, like the United States, who doesn't want to sign this agreement and to fulfill this agreement, should be under our sanctions. So we shouldn't use information technologies which are developed by the countries who sponsor the cyber terrorism, like the United States and Great Britain. This is the second foundation. And the third foundation, which becomes also very actual. As you know, the Americans is the only country in the world which openly violates the International Convention Against the Biological Weapons. As we have seen in Ukraine, the Americans were conducting the elaboration of the biological weapons using the Ukrainian population. So the COVID pandemic is also part of this biological war. So our coalition of the countries which want to finish this hybrid war and to create opportunities for the peaceful, sustainable economic growth, to my mind, should have three basic foundations. The first one is the Treaty Convention on the Issuing of the World Money, which I described. The second one, the Convention Against Cyber Terrorism, which will regulate the use of information technologies in the world. And the third one, the Convention on the Control over the Fulfillment of the Convention on Biological Security. These are three foundations will be enough to create a very powerful worldwide coalition against American aggression. And I think here in Asia, we can be able to create new architecture, financial architecture, trade architecture of economic relations, which will be based on the mutual interests, which will be based on the international law, and which will be quite different from the liberal globalization led by Washington, because each country has its sovereign rights to elaborate those type of regulation of economy which is adequate to its cultural heritage, to the people's norms of behavior, and the diversity of the economic national systems is also the part of this new world economic mode. The main idea of international relations should be creation opportunities for the growth of investments, not trade liberalization, not currency liberalization, but creation of more opportunities for economic growth, for the growth of the well-being of societies, for the growth of the real incomes of the population. So I think together we can organize such kind of new economic mode, which will be attractive for the whole world.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much. We've run out of time, unfortunately. It was very interesting talking to you. And on that positive note, thank you so much. And hopefully, if there's opportunity arises, we can continue this discussion at a later time. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Glazev? If we look at the issue from the perspective of long-term economic cycles analysis, the era of U.S. economic power is coming to an end, and a new era of economic power based in Asia, particularly in China and India, is beginning because of more efficient production models that have been established there in recent years, combining centralized strategic planning with market forces and the channeling of profits into production as opposed to channeling them into the personal wealth of a few wealthy oligarchs. In contrast, the U.S. has shifted from a production-based economy to a financially dominated economy, characterized by extreme wealth gaps and the channeling of profits into the hands of a few oligarchs and into offshore tax havens, instead of into the expansion of production and jobs, an issue central to the Trump and America First campaign and presidency, and one of the keys to understanding the current social and political conflict that exists domestically in the U.S. We can add to this America's endless global war against terror that has been going on for more than 20 years, and which has morally and infrastructurally bankrupted the U.S. with trillions of dollars spent on foreign wars, while basic needs and infrastructure are at a third world level in many parts of the United States. We can further add to this the fact that the Western-dominated global financial and banking systems are losing credibility because of their weaponization by the U.S. to wage economic war against its global rivals and enemies, thus accelerating the emergence of a new non-Western global financial and banking system that allows countries to engage in trade and commerce outside of U.S. dollar hegemony. The geostrategic alignment of China, Russia, and Iran, which the late American geostrategist Zbigniew Brzezinski called America's worst-case scenario,